My name is Charles Lutz, and I work with international issues, including hunger and international economic justice, in the Congregational Life Division for the American Lutheran Church. We provide resources to congregations on global issues and other things. My responsibility is global education. What I thought we'd try to do tonight, in the hour or a little less that we have, is take a quick overview of the current North-South debate, or the rich-poor debate, between the northern industrial nations and the developing nations. It's often called the North-South dialogue, or just the North-South debate. And what I'd like to do is look at some of the theological ways that's being dealt with, or the ways that's being talked about theologically, or in a theological ethics, and then talk about some of the issues that I think are before us in the rest of this century. In my opinion, the major global problem facing the planet, the human community, is the North-South set of issues. That is, the gap between rich and poor. That's the problem not only for the poor, but also for the rich, because it has to do with resource scarcity. It has a lot to do with our jobs, with our style of life, with our consumption patterns, with almost everything that we know in our daily existence. I think that will become clear as we explore the issue this evening. What I want to do in an introductory way is mention a couple of resources that you may be interested in. I think the most helpful book that has been published in the last 5 years on the North-South issue is this little paperback called North-South, A Program for Survival. That's the official title. It's often called popularly the Brandt Commission Report. Willy Brandt, the former Prime Minister of Germany, headed an independent study commission, not representing any of the governments of the world or the UN, but about 30 blue ribbon type people, well-known people, economists, politicians, humanitarian-minded people of the world from both North and South, met for over a couple of years, and about 6 months ago, this report appeared. I think it's very significant, and if these are the kinds of issues that interest you, you may want to have a look at this. Another thing I want to mention as an example of what's available free to any of you from the World Bank is the World Bank Atlas. And I'll pass this around, you can look at it. It has all the data on all of the nations of the world. Per capita income, population, and it's organized by continents, and it's fairly attractively done. You can write to the World Bank, the address is here on the back cover, and ask for this. They publish it annually, and for any of the other free materials they publish. And they're available. There are also publications for sale, but you can ask them to send their catalog of free materials and their catalog of materials for sale, and they will do that. I think the best popular magazine on third world concerns from a third world perspective is this one. It's called The New Internationalist. It's published in Britain. It's basically oriented toward the Western industrial readership, but it's pro-third world in its perspective. And in case some of you have not seen that before, I'll pass that around and you can have a look at it. And then I brought along a single sheet, this canary sheet, two sides, listings of primarily books, but a few films on North-South issues. And that's on the back table, and there are enough of those for each of you to take one along if you wish. Finally, a neat little publication from the United Nations Information Service titled Towards a World Economy That Works. And it's without a lot of text, it's a kind of catechism, question and answer form on what's wrong with the world economy. Why isn't it functioning well for the rich as well as for the poor? And it has some statistics in it and some quick answers to some of the questions in that area. Let me give you a sample of it by beginning with this quote from it. If there's a bad coffee crop in Brazil, the price of breakfast goes up in Vienna and Warsaw. If there's a harvest failure in the Soviet Union, the farmers of Kansas alter their sowing plans, probably also their purchasing and consumption plans. If the price of crude oil is raised in West Asia, the pinch is felt in Boston and Bujumbura. And it goes on to make the point that we are increasingly interdependent because of the international trade in commodities of all kinds. That's a good little piece, and single copies of that are also available free from the UN, if you wish to write for one. As I said, I think the basic global problem for the rest of our century and probably beyond is the gap between rich and poor. It is a problem not only in terms of economics, but it's a problem also that affects the peace of the world. Because I think the major reason for global unrest or for international tension is economic justice. It has to do with increasing scarcity of certain resources. It has to do with who in the world is going to do what for a living, that is, who's going to do certain kinds of jobs. I suppose the favorite way of looking at that theologically from the perspective of the poor is what has come to be known as liberation theology. Liberation theology is a theological approach that takes the Bible very seriously, tends to see the Bible as a third world book, that is, as a book of the oppressed peoples of the earth. And led by theologians of Latin America, but joined also by African and Asian theologians, liberation theology in the last 15 or 20 years has come to be the dominant way that third world peoples and third world Christians talk theologically about the problem. I want to give you a very quick overview, very inadequate, but just a kind of sample of what liberation theology, how it is characterized. And then I want to suggest another theological approach called a theology of relinquishment or a theology of letting go that I think may be more appropriate for the rich, for the have Christians, the have peoples of the earth, to organize their thought. Liberation theology deals centrally with economic and political oppression. It tries to deal with that reality. There are domestic versions of it that borrow heavily from it. Within the United States, within rich countries, there are versions of liberation theology that are adapted to particular groups who feel a kind of oppression. What forms of liberation theology are indigenous to the U.S. or to industrial northern countries? What can you think of?
Feminist theology.
We've had some dealing with that here in the last couple weeks, led by Nancy Allen, who left today. What else within the U.S.? A few years ago, I understand James Cone was here at Holden. He's an exponent of what kind of theology?
Black
theology. He teaches, I think, at Union. I think he's still at Union in New York, Union Seminary. So those are domestic versions of liberation theology. They're kin, they're cousins to the third world liberation theology. Liberation theology from the third world stresses God's identity with the poor, God's bias toward the poor, in fact, that God tilts toward the poor and the oppressed, not because they're nicer people, but because they are poor and oppressed. It often uses Marxist social analysis. And that fact is a problem for some of us, I think, because we are not accustomed to using Marxist analysis in doing theology. Liberation theology does, unashamedly. It is not Marxist in its outcome necessarily, but in its social analysis it uses Marxist techniques, Marxist understandings. It understands salvation to be holistic, that is, including material, political, economic realities here and now, as well as spiritual realities and afterlife. It talks about, I think, as the Bible itself does, about salvation of the whole person. It doesn't know anything about salvation of the soul alone. It talks about the whole person being the object of God's salvation. It sees economic oppression and powerlessness as the basic malady, the basic problem, the basic evil. It uses a lot of imagery from the book of Exodus, as you would expect. from the prophets of the Old Testament. Jesus' words in Luke 4 about why he has come to release the captives, and so on. And Mary's song, the Magnificat, is a favorite text of liberation theology. Liberty to the captives, freedom to the oppressed. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. That kind of reversal of the roles of rich and poor is very attractive to liberation theologians. Well, the question that I have about liberation theology is whether it is the most appropriate or most useful way of dealing with our oppression, the oppression of the wealthy, the oppression of the affluent, the oppression of the over-consuming rich of the world. Another way of saying that is, the basic issue is whether we understand ourselves to be Israelites or Egyptians, to use the Exodus imagery. Last week we had a Bible study here in which we acted out the Exodus story and had people talk about, in terms of our own roles in our culture and our society, are we Egyptians or Israelites? Well, most of us agreed that we're really Egyptians. In some theological sense, perhaps as part of the community of faith, we'd like to identify as Israelites, as the new Israel. But in terms of our culture, our politics, our economics, our place in the world, most of us are Israelites. We're part of, even if we do not wish to be oppressors, and I think most of us do not, we benefit from systems which oppress. We are beneficiaries. We are the privileged people of the earth in terms of the global systems today. So, does liberation theology help us very much? I think we need to know it. I think we need to understand it. I think we need to be very clear about what it is saying. But I'm not sure it's the most helpful way for dealing with our situation, the situation of the prosperous. It is one way. But let me suggest another way, and that's what has been called a theology of relinquishment, a theology of letting go, which suggests, in brief, that the rich of the earth, under God, those who are faithful to the God of all, need to get accustomed to letting go of the control which they, as the wealthy of the earth, have maintained. They need, either voluntarily or involuntarily, to get accustomed to letting go. And that's what I want to spend the rest of our time on. This approach theologically says there's no way the world can be changed, or the relationship between rich and poor can be changed, without our being changed, without the rich. We're speaking in broad terms, of course. Most of us probably don't feel rich within the American economy. But in global terms and in historical terms, all of us in this room are rich, very rich indeed. So you'll forgive me if I use that kind of meat cleaver generality when I talk about rich and poor. There is no way the world, or the relationship between rich and poor in the world, can be changed without you and me being changed. We'd perhaps like to have it otherwise, but it can't happen. The goal in the Old Testament story about the Exodus is not only that the Israelites may go free, but that the Egyptians may be free of their need to oppress, of their need to have a captive people. Or, to put it another way, there is a kind of oppression of not only the slave, but also the slave master. The slave master is oppressed by the need to enslave another. So this analogy says that there is an oppression also which afflicts us, and that we can be liberated from that only by being changed. And that means letting go of some of the control, and some of the advantage, and some of the privilege which we enjoy. I've put on the board, which you probably can't all see, but I'll run it through it, and you can copy it down later if you want. Another way of looking or comparing two views of the rich-poor relationship in the world. The one on the left, which I've headed rescue, the rescue view, is the conventional humanitarian liberal view, which probably many of us have grown up with, that we ought to rescue those poor people. The other one, which is more the relinquishment view, is also, I think, more characteristic of the way the third world sees the problem. In the rescue column, we tend to say they have a problem. They, the poor, have a problem. In the other column, they tend to say we are their problem. I suppose one illustration of that would be the debate over population or over consumption. We tend to say their problem is they have too many babies. If they curbed their population growth, they wouldn't be so poor. Their response to that, while they may agree that population growth is a problem, countries like China are working very hard to control population growth, their answer tends to be that the major problem, the major drain on world resources, is not the growth of population in the South, but the growth in consumption in the North. That the drain on global resources is, most of the figures that you see claim that every American born today will consume 50 times as much as every Indian baby born today. It's that kind of relationship that they're talking about. Our overconsumption is more of a problem than their overpopulation. In the rescue view, we say, well, we will help the victims. And the relinquishment column says that our institutions are creating victims. The institutions we control and maintain, the global arrangements between rich and poor, in trade, in economic patterns, in how much we pay for their goods or whatever, that's what creates victims. The using of third world country resources basically to serve the needs of the North rather than to serve the needs of their own people, much of which grew up during the colonial era and is still in place. That is, their economies, their production patterns are oriented toward export markets rather than toward meeting their own needs, at least in large measure in many of the third world countries. The rescue view says we should give more, we should be more charitable. The relinquishment view says we should take less or pay more for what we take. The rescue view says that the answer is in our generosity. The relinquishment view says, no, the answer is in change in structures, change in global systems. And by the way, that has nothing to do with changing from market capitalism to socialism. It's not that kind of change it's called for. Most of the changes are called for within the market system, the first world, third world system that we know. But the question is who's going to control it and who will it benefit? The rescue view says we are in control, after all. And when you talk about charity and doing more for victims, you're still basically saying, I'm in control. I can decide when to do more or less. The relinquishment view says we are being changed. And we're not in control anymore, and we're going to lose control. And we need to get used to that idea. Well, my own feeling is that there's some truth in both columns. It's also true that internal injustices within the poor countries are part of the problem. There is a rich-poor gap within every third world country. And in many of them, it's more severe than the gap between rich and poor in our own northern nations. There are ruling minorities in most third world countries, ruling elites, from 2 to 5 or 10%, which are really linked in their lifestyle, in their mentality, in their psychology, much more to you and me than to their own mass of their own populations. That's a part of the reality. And so reform within third world countries is also needed. But our chief responsibility, it seems to me, is to influence changes in the international system which our kind of people, still control, as we are able, and to prepare ourselves psychologically and spiritually for the economic impact on us of what is to come. So the question would be, how do the people of God who wish to be faithful minister to themselves, to the children of Egypt, which includes us, once the oppressed have gone free? In other words, what do we do with ourselves when OPECs happen? When oil goes up and other commodity prices go up and our lifestyle is changed and our consumption levels are reduced because of that, do we see that only as bad news? Or can we see that as good news for us as well? Now that's a big subject in itself, and we could spend a whole hour just on the energy question and the kind of loss or death of cheap energy that we're all experiencing and what that's going to mean for us. I insist that there's a way of seeing that kind of change as good news also for us. Painful, unpleasant, but still basically good news. A theology of letting go assumes certain things, which I think are biblical. It assumes that God's promise to us is that we will have enough, but not that all of our greeds will be satisfied. That our needs will be met, but not our greeds, as Gandhi put it. It assumes that material growth, constant increase in what we call standard of living, always strikes me as a rather quaint phrase, because it's not about quality of life, but about quantity of consumption. Standard of living is about quantity of consumption, right? Not about quality. Standard of living is not the final, is not the bottom line, is not the final promise of God that our standard of living will constantly increase. A theology of letting go, therefore, assumes that material growth is not the highest priority. It assumes that the acquisition of goods and an increase in my consumption is no blessing of God once my basic needs are met. It assumes that moderation or sufficiency is the promise, not endless increase in consumption, extravagant and wasteful use of resources. It assumes that justice and adjustments in the systemic realities, that is, the global systems, the global patterns of relationships, are more important than charity. Justice and adjustments in the global systems are more important than charity. It assumes, finally, that God is at work in the world, and part of God's objective, justice objective, is to bring greater equity, is to reduce that gap between rich and poor, both between nations and within nations. What I'd like to do, and spend, I think, the bulk of our time on, is five illustrations of debates that are currently going on. There are many others, but these are five of the major ones. That if the success that the third world seeks is accomplished, that will change us. That will change us dramatically, as dramatically as the OPEC pricing of oil has changed our lives. And it's regrettable that most of these are debates that most of us know very little about, because our press has not reported them very much to us. The press assumes that we wouldn't be interested, or it's too technical. But they are highly significant, and I think we need to know them better. Much of this debate goes under the heading New International Economic Order. It is part of a call about 5 years ago that was launched by the Third World Nations through the UN, the global forum for debating these issues, that was called the New International Economic Order. And I should say again that it is basically a call for modification, more fairness within the existing market system. It is not a call for replacing market capitalism with socialism. So it is basically a conservative program. It is not radical at all, except that it seems radical to us in its impact on us as we project what will happen if it begins to succeed. Five things I've listed. I want to say a little bit about each one of them, and then at any point now, if you want to stop me and ask for more clarity or say something about it, feel free to do that. The five areas are terms of trade, define that in a minute, access to markets, debt relief, transnational corporation regulation, that is, regulation of transnational corporations, and the law of the sea. Terms of trade, what is that about? What do you think that's about? What does it sound like? It's about prices. It's very much like what American farmers talk about when they say the word parity. It's how much will what I have to sell buy. It's not the actual price as much as the relationship between the price of exports and the price of imports. It's for American farmers, how much will a bushel of wheat buy in food that they have to buy, or chemicals or gasoline or inputs for agriculture. It's that kind of relationship. We talk about that in terms of parity, farmers do, and in the third world terms of trade discussion, it's usually called equity. So that will a ton of rubber from Malaysia this year buy as much as it bought 5 years ago? That's the kind of discussion that's going on, and the third world countries are very upset because their terms of trade have been worsening over the last 15 years, dramatically. The fact is that most third world countries for their international exchange depend on one or two primary commodities, raw materials. And almost without exception, the only exception, there is one exception. What? Oil is the one exception. Almost without exception, except for oil, their terms of trade have been worsening. Their costs of imports, industrial products that they must buy and import, have been going up much faster than the price of their raw materials, which they export and depend on. And as long as the world is wired the way it is, most of the developing countries depend on primary products, either unprocessed or very little processed raw materials. That's what they sell to the world in the world market. And most of them do not have much industrial capacity yet, so they have to import industrial things, including, increasingly for some of them, food. Food is a raw material or food is a processed commodity. What primary commodities do third world countries export that you can think of?
Coffee.
Sugar.
Diamonds.
Rubber.
Diamonds.
Bananas.
Yeah, diamonds come heavily from South Africa, which isn't exactly a third world country, but there are third world people in South Africa, but some third world countries. Tanzania, I think, has some diamond production, and there are a few others.
Well, other jewels.
Rice.
Copra.
Copra. Other beverages.
Tea.
Sugar.
Yeah, sugar. Cocoa. Did somebody mention cocoa? What about minerals? Metals.
Copper.
Bauxite.
Rubber.
Rubber was mentioned.
Gold.
Copper. Price of gold has been going up, but again, for some reason, South Africa seems to be the world's leading producer of gold and doesn't really fit the description of a third world country in its economy. In product after product, you can go down and see how the purchasing power of a unit of that commodity has shrunk in the last 15 or so years. And that data is available if you're interested in it. Some of the proposals for dealing with it would be something like indexing, a cost of living index. We have built into our Social Security system now and built into many union contracts in this country an escalator clause, or a cost of living clause. If the cost of something, if the cost of consumer price index goes up, then the wage goes up or the benefit goes up. Well, the first world countries haven't agreed to that kind of arrangement yet, I think for good reason. It is very inflationary. The problem is that the global inflation, which is a reality, is being borne disproportionately by the poor, by the third world countries who can least afford it. It hits them even worse than it hits us, in fact, in terms of their international earnings, because of the terms of trade. There are some proposals that are a little more complex, like creating buffer stocks of raw materials when they're in abundant supply, and leveling out the peaks and valleys of price fluctuation with buffer stocks. Not much has happened in the negotiation on terms of trade. Another one, and I think probably even more threatening to us, is access to markets. They're asking for access to our markets in the industrial world, not with their raw materials, which they already have, but with processed goods. And why don't we want to give them that access? They're asking for free access, that is, without tariff barriers or other kinds of restrictions, without quotas, but free access. Why don't we want to give that?
Balance of trade?
We can't compete.
Not really.
So much less.
We can't.
Okay, they have a surplus of low-priced labor. And if they could employ their people to process their own raw materials at home and then ship them to us, processed, not as raw materials, they would be a threat to us in what way? Who would be threatened by that?
Our workers.
Wouldn't our consumers benefit? If they can make it for less, wouldn't we get a lower price for it? Well, according to capitalist theory, yes, we would. According to market economy theory, we would. But the people affected immediately are people in the industries concerned.
Labor.
Our workers. Not even our corporations so much, because they can move, and they have been. And they've been relocating in other parts of the world to take advantage of cheaper labor. But our workers can't so easily migrate. So, for example, we have still no tariff whatever on raw cocoa beans, but we have a tariff of about 25% on processed cocoa. Who is that protecting? Not only we, but Swiss, the Dutch, the English, all of the manufacturers of cocoa products. It's protecting people in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere in the cocoa industry. It's understandable. There's not only competition between Japanese automakers and Detroit, that's a first world to first world relationship, but increasingly there is competition from third world workers. We have signed a major trade agreement within the last year with the People's Republic of China. China wants to buy certain things from us. But in order for China to be able to do that, we have to be able to buy something from China. There has to be a trade-off. So what are we going to buy in large quantities from the Chinese? Do you know? Textiles. Exactly. So there has already been a threat to our textile industry from the Asian Rim countries, Taiwan and Korea and the Philippines and Hong Kong, and now from the whole continent of the People's Republic, those billion people, because they can make clothing and they have a cotton, domestic cotton resource, they can make clothing and ship it over here, and it'll be cheaper in our stores than we can make it ourselves because of our wage scale. All right, it's that kind of thing that the third world countries are pressing for. Free access to the markets of the northern nations without any restriction at the border. The trend has been which direction in recent years in the United States? Toward more protectionism or less?
More.
Toward more. Because as our own economy has problems, politicians find it very difficult to resist the pressure from affected unions, affected workers in that area. And that's understandable within our own economy. In capitalist theory, in Adam Smith theory, the best of all worlds is one in which there is free trade. Because then there is no artificial inflating of the price. Then every people does what it can most efficiently do with the resources and the know-how it has, and trade that with the other nations. So protectionism doesn't make economic sense except in the short run and for a particular group of affected people. And the voters, whom our politicians respond to, are workers in America. They're not workers in the People's Republic of China or in Peru. So that's a major area of debate, and how to deal with it is very difficult. There don't seem to be answers except to continue to work away at negotiating and reducing tariffs and opening up freedom of trade. Debt relief. Many of the developing countries now spend in current years as much to service the debt of the past as they receive in aid or development assistance from other countries. In other words, all of their development assistance goes none of it for capital development or creating new jobs within their own economy, but to service the debt of the past. And the irony is that much of that debt of the past for many of those countries is the aid of the past. We tend to have the view that aid is a gift, right? That foreign aid is a free gift, no strings. Well, it isn't. Much of the aid which this country and other developed countries give is long-term loans. It is considered aid because it is less than the market interest rate. It is a good deal. It is the best money they could get on a loan basis. But it's still a loan that has to be repaid. So there's a major debt burden for many of the developing countries, and their economies have become stagnant because servicing that debt, which is as high as for some of them, 30 or 40% of all of their international exchange earnings, has become a major burden. Well, what are countries doing? Canada, the Netherlands, a few other countries in recent years have been forgiving some of that debt, meaning they're paying it off themselves. They're paying themselves for it. If it's owed to private investors in Canada, for example, the Canadian taxpayer is paying it. Or some have said, we're going to make this year's aid or part of this year's aid to you developing country X, forgiveness of a certain share of the debt that you owe to us. A lot of the debt is owed to governments, but much of it is owed to private, most of it, in fact, is owed to private lenders in the North. I guess the most, this book's, the Brandt Commission's proposals for dealing with the debt problem are probably the most sweeping and far-reaching. And they propose that there be a kind of automatic transfer of resources from North to South built into the global system to deal with the debt of the South and the long-term development of the South. And they really make two proposals that, well, they make many, but two that I think are especially attractive. One is to put a tax on all arms sales, all international sales of arms would have a sales tax on them, say 5%. And that tax, no matter who is selling and who buying, that tax would go into a development fund to assist the third world countries. Their argument is, if the world's going to continue the stupidity of the arms trade, let's at least get a way out of that of benefiting the developing countries. That's one proposal. Another proposal is to tax the mining of the resources of the international commons, the international territory which belongs to no one nation. Where is that? What is the international commons that belongs to all humanity?
Oceans.
The deep oceans. That's not the offshore fishing rights issue. This takes us to the last point. We'll take it up now. The law of the sea, a major part of the negotiating in the law of the sea has to do with who is going to have the right to exploit the mineral resources of the deep ocean, the seabed, and who is going, and how, under what terms will that be done? The developing countries argue in the law of the sea negotiations that that does not belong to the rich countries. It isn't under our flag, under our flags. Just because we have the capital and the technical know-how and the appetite for what's there, because we have the capital to go, there are companies anxious to go and start exploiting that as soon as an agreement is signed. And the poor countries are saying, hold on a minute, that doesn't belong to you just because you have the companies and the need for those resources. Many of them are minerals that we're running out of on land. And they're saying, we won't permit that kind of exploitation of those resources until there's an agreement signed. And we're fairly close to an agreement, but not quite there. The agreement usually includes, I mean, the negotiation includes, and the agreement probably will include, some provision for a tax on all of the ore that is mined from the deep seabed, a portion of which will go into a development fund for the third world countries. That would be very much like, if you're from Minnesota, for years the iron ore that has gone out of Minnesota has had a tax on it, and the tax has benefited the communities of the Iron Range. Coal is taken out of Montana, there's a tax on it, a severance tax on the resource, and that benefits Montana. It's that kind of thing that the third world countries are pressing for, and we seem to be fairly close to an agreement in that area. So both of those, taxing arms sales and taxing the mining of the global commons, would move towards some kind of automaticity, making automatic the transfer from north to south of resources. There are other forms of global taxation that are proposed, but those seem to be the most attractive at this point. It is trying to create a structure by which aid from the north to the south is not dependent on the whim of governments in the north from year to year, as it is now. That would make income transfers more automatic, as they are now within industrial countries, from rich to poor, just as welfare, income support, income maintenance, even Social Security is a kind of automatic transfer once it's written into law within our society. This would be an international attempt to make the income transfers to some degree automatic and dependable. Behind all of that talk about income transfer, there's a talk not only about the method by which it's done, but the quantity. The goal adopted by the UN, by all of the nations of the UN, including the United States, some years ago, was 0.7%. 0.7% of the gross national product of the developed countries. each year should be devoted to income transfers to the southern countries. 1% is the goal, is the level that some countries have already reached, but 7/10 overall should be the goal. Well, we're far short of that. Overall, we're at 0.3%. The United States is down around 0.2% and falling, or probably under 0.2% now this year. The countries that are up around 1% of gross national product in aid are which? Do you know which countries are up there?
Scandinavian
countries. Sweden is at the top. Norway and Denmark are up there also. Who else?
Netherlands,
yeah. You know where Canada is? Canada is at about 0.5%, about 2.5 times in proportion to what we're doing, in proportion to ability, in proportion to size of their economy. Great Britain, United Kingdom is ahead of us, France, West Germany.
Japan.
We're down with Japan. Japan is low. Japan and Italy, we're down there. We're 13th or 14th, depending on which year you look at, out of 17 countries in the industrial world that give aid regularly. Now, the socialist countries are not even involved in all of this because they don't appear on the list. They don't give aid in that fashion, except to other socialist countries. So it's basically a first world, third world dialogue that's going on, and the socialist countries have not been a very big part of it. Let me mention one other case that is a part of the five, the big five, and then we'll have some discussion about this. The other one is what to do with the transnational corporations. I think all parties involved in the North-South dialogue agree that they will not go away. Even if you wanted them to go away, they're going to be here for some time. These are the multinational corporations that are mostly based, home-based in what part of the world? Well, the United States, but the North or the West. The Western part of the North. The Northern world includes the socialist countries of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. There aren't many transnational corporations based there. It's a phenomenon of the first world, of the market capitalist first world. But increasingly, they operate around the whole world. They operate particularly in third world countries, either producing things there, marketing things there, processing things there, extracting, whatever. They do all of those things. They are increasingly active in host countries of the third world, though they are still controlled from home countries in the first world. What to do about them is the big debate. How do you put them under some kind of global regulation, some kind of code of conduct that will be recognized by all of them and all of the parties involved, the home countries and the host countries? Some of the issues involve how much profit they can expatriate back to their shareholders at home, what percentage of their workforce should be indigenous as opposed to, take Honeywell or 3M from where I live in the Twin Cities. How much of the workforce that they have in an African country, let's say, should be African, and how much should come from Minnesota or the United States? What percentage of control of the company in that country should be with local people? All kinds of questions like that, and it really boils down to the fact that the corporations, even though many of them do good things for the host country, are the bottom line for all of them is profitability for shareholders back home. That's what they're in business for. And that's not knocking them to say that. That's just the way it is. So how do you put the behavior of the corporations, what is acceptable under some body of law? There is no body of law now internationally that governs their behavior. The interesting thing about it is that the companies themselves are a part of the dialogue with great, in most cases, with great interest, because they would like to have a code of conduct too. As they say to you, we would behave more responsibly if our competitor had to abide by the same rules. Mm-hmm. So as long as the rules are agreed to and it affects everybody the same, many of the companies say they'd prefer that to a kind of anarchic situation which they have now. Other companies, of course, are not so interested in any kind of regulation. Let me stop there, because that I could go on and on with other examples, but I think that's enough to give you a little bit of a picture of the dialogue that's going on and the difficulty and what it implies for us as the little by little the pieces of it begin to be put into place. All of those pieces gradually will affect us, just as the increase in oil prices has affected us, even though it may not seem as dramatic. But I think in the long run, the same kind of changes will come to our lives and our lifestyles. Do any of you have comments or questions about any of that? Do you have solutions? Do you have, how do you feel? Is this threatening, or do you see some positive, constructive, good news in this picture of trying to reshape the world economy in a way that's more just? How does it strike you? Yeah.
Would you describe briefly how international agencies like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund grant aid in the name of developed countries?
That could be a sixth case here. It's the behavior of the international lending institutions and the international monetary system itself. That's a part of the issue. It's a little more complex, and it's more difficult for me, at least, to interpret it. So I didn't include that. But on your question, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are both international agencies related to the UN. They're part of the United Nations system, but they're also apart from it. They have their own board of directors. The World Bank is the largest, in fact, it's become the largest aid-giving institution in the world. And most of what it has done under Robert McNamara in the last 10 years, he's been the president of it, has been oriented toward third world needs. The bank has been criticized not so much because of the kind of projects it funds. It tends to fund major development projects like a dam or building a transportation system or something like that in a developing country. It's faulted sometimes for the kinds of projects, but more it's faulted for the control. And the control is not, it is not one nation, one vote, as in the General Assembly of the UN. It's according to the size of the economy of the countries that are members of the World Bank. So that the United States currently, I think this is still accurate, has 21% of the votes in the World Bank because of the size of our economy. Of course, the developing countries have very little vote, even all put together. They may have 15 or 20% of the vote. There are four, I believe this is still correct, it was true a few years ago, four Western nations controlled 51% of the votes in the World Bank. The United States, Japan, West Germany, and I think the United Kingdom. If those four got together, they could control the World Bank decision-making process. Now that kind of representation or power within those institutions is one of the issues that third world countries are fussing about. They want that change so that they have more voice. And some other basis than simply the size of economy is probably going to have to be come to. The International Monetary Fund, let me say a word about that. They've been faulted most by the third world countries for before they will give a loan to bail out an economy that's in trouble. Take the case of Jamaica a few years ago. Before the IMF would agree to that loan, they forced Jamaica to agree to a number of conditions, which Jamaica didn't like but had to accept. And very often the IMF policies, at least as a third world country sees it, are anti-human development, anti-social programs, and pro-free enterprise, big business kind of development in those countries. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the charge from the third world. So that Jamaica, which was a kind of social democracy, the conditions they had to agree to were heavily in the area of social and human welfare programs. That's what they had to eliminate from their economy, which fell immediately on the poorest within Jamaica. And the left alone seemed to be the big business interests in Jamaica. So it's that kind of attack that the third world countries are often leveling at the IMF. It's interesting that in most third world countries, the IMF is a household word. But in the United States, most people don't know what it means. I visited Jamaica a few years ago, and there were slogans plastered all over on walls in that country, in Kingston, the capital. Political slogans like, IMF equals is Manley fault. Manley, Michael Manley was the prime minister of Jamaica, and the opposition was blaming Manley for for accepting the restrictive policies that came to their economy, especially to the poor, under the IMF agreement. Many third world countries feel that those international monetary institutions have a life and death control over their economies, and they resent it. And they, you know, have really very little, they have almost nowhere else to turn because they're part of the world economy, and they have no choice but to accept the conditions, but they don't like it. Yeah, Eric.
Are IMF funds generated?
They come from, our Congress votes every year on what it will put into the World Bank and into the IMF, and then, as with any bank, they generate their own funds. They lend and get funds back, and so it's like a bank. It's a lending institution, but they come from the economies primarily of the wealthy countries. Yeah. I don't know how it would be handled mechanically. It would be an international fund for development. I think it would almost have to be governed strongly by the developing countries. That is, they'd have to have more say in how it's distributed, what the regulations are for dealing with it, than is the case with the World Bank at present. But I haven't read anything on the details of that, how it would be done. It might, we're so far from doing that that it's almost an academic question. I don't think we're even close to any kind of automatic income transfer from north to south. The countries that would be most affected by that in terms of the donor side are just not ready. We want to maintain control over that from year to year so that we can go up or down. And also, frankly, so that we can use carrot and stick. We can reward our friends and we can punish our non-friends who don't behave correctly. A lot of foreign aid is dealt with that way. As soon as you put it into an international or a multilateral pot, you lose control. We would lose control. And we couldn't, because of a change of government in Nicaragua, let's say, we couldn't say, we're going to stop giving aid to you. We like to maintain that direct one-on-one relationship so that we can still extend it or pull it back. The other thing about aid that you need to know is that much of it is tied. What is tied aid? You know what tied aid is? The aid that we give to a developing country is said to be tied. What does that mean?
There are strings.
There are strings on it. What kind of strings?
Might have to buy
political
stuff from
strings?
Yeah, it's usually in the area of they have to buy American. They get the money to use, whether it's a loan or a grant. They get the resource, but then we tell them how they have to spend the resource. And both for commodities, materials, and for personnel, in the past, much of our aid has been tied. They have to employ Americans to advise them. Keep a lot of strings on the aid that is bilateral. And that's another complaint of the third world countries, that they say it isn't genuine aid as long as we follow it all the way to the spending of it and it comes back into our economy to benefit our economy. But frankly, it's a political problem, and the only way of getting aid of any kind through Congress has usually been to tie it to spending back in our own economy, a large portion of it.
And Chuck, isn't it true that much of our outright aid goes to places like Korea and Pakistan and places where we want to continue to have their friendship?
Yeah, another issue is that we tend to give our aid not to those who need it most. That's not the criterion, but to those that whose governments we want to prop up, or for international strategic reasons, or military reasons, or Cold War reasons. We give it to certain countries and not to other countries. I mentioned Nicaragua. Nicaragua's revolution a year ago led to new hope for a lot of people who observed that, because land reform was promised, but it's a very poor country, and the Somoza regime left it even poorer when it pulled out, took a lot of wealth with it. And so this country had talked about a major aid package to Nicaragua to help keep Nicaragua within, I suppose, the family of nations that we're friendly with. It's been very hard to get that through Congress, and the main reason is that many in Congress fear it'll go to create another Cuba, that there are socialists in Nicaragua, or that Cuba is too friendly with Nicaragua. And so aid is usually voted in Congress not purely on a, I guess I could say aid is always voted in Congress on a basis of our self-interest. Aid, until very recent years, went to a few countries that we thought were key in the Cold War. Iran was one of them, South Korea, South Vietnam, Taiwan. And when governments changed in those countries, even though the need may have been just as great, the aid may have been cut off. So some countries have a better record than we do, but we're a superpower, and we seem to behave in a very political or very Cold War kind of way with our aid, including our food aid.
I've got a question.
Yeah, this probably has to be the last one.
Getting back to the tariffs you made before, if we didn't have tariffs and tried to help out the underdeveloped country that way, do you think our economy could survive? You know, like, so we didn't have a tariff, so the Hershey mineral, we get processed cocoa beans.
Yeah.
What happens to the Hershey people? What could
we? Well, that's there. It would. I think our economy could survive. It would be changed. The way other countries are dealing with that is through something called trade adjustment. They will appropriate public funds to help retrain workers and retool factories that are affected, where it can be demonstrated that it's because of eliminating tariff barriers against third world countries. The Netherlands has probably led the way on that. And they've tried to do that as part of their help to the third world country. They'll eliminate trade barriers, and then their workers who are affected can get, I think it's 2 years of benefits, during which time they get retraining. It's a kind of workers or unemployment compensation for affected workers. And there are ways of doing that. Other countries are trying to do it. But, you know, we've the United States, West Germany, and Japan have been the most resistant in the whole area of protectionism and have the worst records. And I don't think we're quite ready to enact that sort of legislation yet, especially with our economy in the trouble it is at home. But there are ways of dealing with that. Well, thank you very much.